I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Are we on the verge of a second renaissance? Patricia Martin thinks so. In her new book, Ren Gen, she writes that cultural consumers are at the heart of this new generation and that a surprising group of cities will emerge as the new centers of this second renaissance. Central to a renaissance is learning, and libraries are fundamental to learning. Martin Gomez is president of the Urban Libraries Council, an organization of leading libraries reinventing their futures in a digital world. We'll talk with Patricia Martin and Martin Gomez today on Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Author, consultant, and recognized expert in cultural marketing, Patricia Martin is president of Chicago-based LitLamp Communications Group, the firm she founded in 1995. The firm has worked with a variety of organizations, including Discovery Channel, the Art Institute of Chicago, Brooklyn Public Library, National PTA, the New York Philharmonic, and Target. She contributes regular commentary for Crain's Chicago Business and was named a purple cow by marketing guru Seth Godin. Patricia, who is the Renaissance generation?
The Renaissance generation is really more of a mindset than it is a specific age group, Carolyn. In fact, what we're seeing in not only in the Renaissance, but in the broadest possible definition of the mass culture right now, it is defying that kind of segmentation to begin with. So we're seeing the rise of a mindset marketplace and a decline of a segmentation. If I had to, though, really nail it down, in ethnographic terms, a generation is defined as a 30-year swath of individuals who are living contemporaneously. As we looked at the data on who's most active in the cultural consumer marketplace, it kind of bookended out. So what we had is a large contingency of boomers and a very large contingency of younger individuals between the ages of 16 and 28. When they get to hit their 30s, there's a certain hollowing out, if you will.
Now, how do you explain that? That's interesting. You're saying that boomers have something in common with 16 to 30-year-olds?
Yes, they do. And in fact, there's very interesting research came out of the University of Michigan anthropology department a couple years ago, and what they discovered is that in very advanced civilizations that were noted for a lot of cultural expression, creative output, those civilizations had one thing in common. They had an older generation that was encouraging a younger generation to be creative.
And what form does that encouragement take?
Well, what you're seeing is an older generation is encouraging their children or even their grandchildren to do things like go to art school, to make independent film and video. I mean, we interviewed some really interesting independent film and video makers for the book. And one story really stuck with me was the Brothers McMullen production. And that was done, of course, on a shoestring, a Visa card, and $25,000 from mom and dad.
Is that because mom and dad are so much better off financially today than they were, say, a generation ago? Can they indulge their children's creativity?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about the fact that part of why we're seeing this growth in the cultural consumer marketplace is that there's more abundance.
Now, you said that it is a mindset that binds this Ren-Gen together, this Renaissance generation together. Describe that mindset.
Well, the mindset has a number of factors that are interplaying with it. First of all, it has an aesthetic, meaning it likes things to look and feel a certain way. And that aesthetic is, it's contradicting a lot of what had dominance in the 80s and 90s in the consumer marketplace. So, for instance, this is a generation that takes its cues from the natural world. And so they're accepting a certain level of imperfection in order to have something that's more authentic and more ecologically sound. At the root of this generation's anxieties, if you will, sort of their collective consciousness, is a real understanding now that we live in an environment where we've poisoned the planet and we're not terribly sure how we're going to address that as a world culture. And so, you know, there's a phrase I coin in the book called ecophobia. And this is certainly prominent in the deep psychology of this generation. So what that means is you're going to see a rise in the marketplace of acceptance of products that are less than perfect, but they are eco-friendly. So this spring, for instance, in garden centers, the preferred pots for planting flowers were these gnarly, biodegradable pots that were messy and unattractive over the perfect green plastic plants that were not biodegradable. So you're going to see the demise of the tyranny, the perfectionist tyranny of Martha Stewart.
I read recently that Costco is introducing a new line with Martha Stewart. Do you see any evidence that a Martha Stewart and the perfection that, as you say, she represents is in fact in some sort of decline or is being challenged?
Well, let's give Martha Stewart credit for being a very smart businesswoman. She just acquired Body and Soul magazine. And there you have an example of a magazine that is aimed at more of a Ren-Gen thinker. And that leads me to want to talk just a little bit about Ren-Gen spirituality, because that's certainly a feature as well. Ren-Gen spirituality is it's a good place to talk about another feature of Ren-Gen mindset, and that is it's a world driven by fusion. The fusion of disparate two disparate things is, you know, paradoxical, but it works for this generation. So, for instance, one of the people I interviewed for the book was a gentleman who was an undertaker, and he had sold the big family undertaking chain and now had a storefront for people who wanted to plan their own funerals. So this was like wedding planning, only it was for a funeral. And I asked him, I said, you know, in these big landmarks in our lives, you know, that's when you see traditional values come into being and they become important for people. And he said, oh, yes, indeed. What he was seeing is, and he put it to me this way, he says, I've never seen a Catholic yet who didn't want last rites and a priest to say the prayers, but they also wanted their yogi to be present to say a few words and their drumming circle.
So it's all about fusion.
It is about fusion. If the 20th century was defined by fission, and that means the splitting of the atom, the dividing up of people into socioeconomic groups, what we're seeing with the Ren-Gen is a coming together. So I think one of the most intriguing things that I uncovered in the research was how what a cross-platform arts and culture can be. So, for instance, we found that across ethnic groups and people who were newly arrived to the United States, they held in great esteem the expression of culture. Now, it might have been defined differently, so they wanted to go to things that were more traditional and were a reflection of the country they came from. Their children, however, wanted to participate in all of the popular culture that was, you know, could define, you know, American culture. But still in all, it's cross-platform. And I think the other thing that's important to understand is this is no longer the arts, culture, and you know, that broad swath of things that we deem our creative cultural output is no longer defined and segregated to the wealthy. We saw participation across lots of different socioeconomic groups, and I want to underline economics. So again, it's no longer a place that is segregated and divided. It's a place that's, as they say in the internet lingo, it's a big mashup.
Interesting. That's an interesting viewpoint. You see evidence in history for the rise of this Renaissance generation.
Yes, I do. In fact, you know, I started off thinking that this was really, I've always believed that, you know, art, culture, education, it was very niche, and there wasn't an unlimited audience for it. And I was happy working away in my niche because I was a pioneer, and when you're a pioneer in a niche, you know, you really get to sort of own the space. It wasn't until I began to see certain indicators that there was more output than I had expected, and there was more interest than I was aware of. And there were a couple of things that keyed me into that. First of all, you know, I saw things like David Sedaris, the author, sell out an auditorium of 5,000 people within 24 hours. You know, he's an author who reads from his book. And, you know, this sort of triggered in me a curiosity. That curiosity, you know, accumulated around other facts that I was finding. I took a trip to Rome really on a completely different project. And it was there as I sort of stood in the Sistine Chapel and I looked up at that work by Michelangelo and I thought to myself, what brings about a Renaissance? And as I began finding the data that answered that question, it opened me to understand what was happening in the deep structure of our culture. So whereas there's been some really interesting work around cultural creatives by Paul Ray, by the creative economy, by Richard Florida, there's a deeper reason why all of this is happening. And the deeper reason is that we are poised for a second Renaissance. And here's what that looks like. And here's what it looked like, you know, in Italy in 1300. There is a universal sense among the dominant civilization that it is in decline. And there's another feature that's important. In Rome, for instance, there was not a sense necessarily that it was, you know, the decline of the Republic and the rise of the emperors. It was corruption. It was overreaching. I mean, there were a lot of reasons for why Rome brought itself down. But chief among all those reasons, and it was cited by the chroniclers of the Renaissance, was that the Romans had lost their political will. They no longer believed that anything they said or did made a difference in the political outcome of their environment. And with that, they lost their sense of striving. They lost their work ethic. They lost the very things that defined them as Romans. And, you know, you only have to pick up a newspaper or go online and begin to sort of see this playing out in the American psyche.
And so what do you see as the logical outcome of those developments?
Well, here's what happens. I mean, history teaches us. There's usually, all civilizations, by the way, have this period of decline that they experience. And, you know, there are some sociologists who say that that's inherent. It's built in. There's just a rise and fall. What goes up must come down, right? And then there are other theorists who say, no, really what happens is there's a catastrophe and the civilization can't address it. My theory in the book is that the Rengen will be brought about by both of those things, that the decline is somewhat inherent. However, it will be exacerbated or sped by a catastrophe that we're not prepared to address. And while I looked at a lot of things, you know, and I don't have a crystal ball, but I looked at a lot of things that would sort of, you know, what would be on the horizon that would threaten us. And the truth of it is that we're already in it, and that is the environment. People already fundamentally believe that they're not really sure that we have put ourselves as a civilization in a position where we will survive 200 years of, you know, relentless progress at any price. And so how this sort of triggers a Renaissance is once the civilization believes it's threatened, and in Rome and across Europe, it was the bubonic plague.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be in a situation where you are profoundly, as a civilization, problem solving for something you've never encountered before and you don't have a solution for. This puts the collective mindset in a position of sort of getting its mental muscles in shape. And it's almost as if the culture just doesn't even know, it's sort of unwitting about this, just in the same way as when you crave certain foods, it's because you're lacking in a certain vitamin. You don't really know that. All you know is you're craving the food. And this is what's happening in the culture today. People are craving information because, you know, the brain researchers that I looked at, you know, their work, what they discovered is, you know, people who can problem solve at a very rapid pace have a lot more information in their heads. So it's interesting to me that in this society now, we search for information online more often than we drive our cars or drink coffee.
You say, Patricia, that there are second cities of the Renaissance, and you've developed your own criteria for cities of the Renaissance. What criteria did you use and why?
The criteria is sort of self-invented. I worked with two other researchers on the book, and we looked at a couple of cities where it's true. We didn't look at every city, but we looked at a couple of cities where we really thought, these are really Ren-Gen cities. One thing is that they had to have some important infrastructure. So they had to have, they had to be dense. You had to have a lot of people living in them, sort of mashed up together. But then you had to have a good circulatory system. So there had to be, you know, good roads, good pedestrian ways. In other words, people had to be able to move about freely and in close proximity so that they could share ideas and information. The other thing they had to have is they had to have catalytic personalities. And the catalytic personalities are the people who actually go out. They could be arts patrons. They can be, you know, mayors of cities. But they set a certain destiny for that city, and they are relentless in pursuing it. Mm-hmm. And I think the other ingredient is it is important. You have to have a lot of ways to learn in a city. So we saw the Ren-Gen cities as having a couple things in common. They did have a good infrastructure for arts and culture. They did have a good public library system. They usually had a major university or two, and they had good media outlets within those cities, so that the exchange of ideas is pretty facile. And finally, they were all green cities. They had green initiatives of one kind or another.
And which cities emerged from your analysis?
Well, now I have to be really honest. This is in the spirit of full disclosure. I live in Chicago, and I love Chicago. And, you know, I was very reluctant to deem Chicago a Ren-Gen city because I thought, you know, well, it's my hometown. But in reality, it met many of the criteria. And so Chicago's one of the Ren-Gen cities, and some, you know, surprising cities. Providence, Rhode Island has really got a lot going for it, and it has experienced a downtown renaissance really brought on by, you know, some business leaders and some political leaders who willed it so, funded it to be so, and, you know, you've got a nice mix of university programs that are, I thought, were really fabulous. So, for instance, they have a rebate program if you're an artist and you'd like to establish a business in an otherwise blighted area. You not only get a lot of funding to do that by way of a facade rebate, but they also partner you with a business partner from the Economic Council or the Chamber of Commerce. So it's really interesting when you go to Providence and you go to a business event and you can have, you know, the typical, you know, banker in a gray suit and, you know, a woman in purple hair. Seattle was another favorite of ours just because Seattle has a lot of ambition that's almost overflowing. It's a town that's been founded by entrepreneurs. You know, it didn't fit all the criteria. In fact, one of the challenges, I think, for Seattle is that it has a consensus model for setting policy and making change. And we talked to many Seattleans who were frustrated by that and actually wished that they had a, you know, a benevolent tyrant who would just say, we're building this and that's the end of it, instead of 15 council meetings where they sort of discuss the various ups and downs of whether they should do something. And then there's Philadelphia. Philadelphia is a real sleeper. Philadelphia has great infrastructure. They have great funding sources. But the main thing is that New York has become way too expensive to be a Ren-Gen city. It can't sustain its own arts population. So a lot of the creative, it's kind of a Rome. and it will be the staging area for art and ideas and technologies that are created elsewhere and brought to that marketplace. They won't be indigenously invented there.
And what do you want your readers to understand when they finish this book?
I think the big takeaway from the book is, you know, after 20 years of discourse out in the world, especially the business world, that led people to believe a couple of things are no longer true. The first thing is that you need to understand the average consumer now, the average Joe in America, no longer wants to be marketed to as if they're below average. They like to see themselves as being bright and creative, and they want to be marketed to that way. And the second thing is, we are not trapped in an endless cycle of decline that has no bottom. In fact, the time in which we live is the end of the end, but it's also the beginning of the beginning, and this is a rare and wonderful time to be alive.
Patricia Martin is author of Ren Gen. Planet is an assistant editor. Nate Berg has the latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development.
Every year, more than 80 million people are added to the world's urban population, and 35 million of them end up in slums. The magnitude of this problem is huge, and some are warning that the world's supply of architects and planners is too low and too inexperienced to tackle it. An article in the International Herald Tribune examines this issue, which is further exacerbated by the lopsided concentration of the world's planners and architects. Many of these professionals tend to end up in developed countries, but it is in those developing countries where they are needed the most. And while some say that this concentration is explained by the fact that developed countries have the money to pay planners and architects, others argue it is the education system that doesn't put enough emphasis on teaching about the problems faced by the developing world. Another problem facing urban areas is the lack of locally grown food. But the city of Detroit has taken an innovative step to bring farming and gardening back into the urban makeup. The Detroit Free Press reports that the city offers free permits to farm on any of its 20,000 vacant lots, a program that has brought life and food to formerly blighted areas. Detroit residents have been able to use these urban micro-farms to create niche markets for locally grown food, with some of the farmers even making deals with local restaurants that regularly buy their crops. Many in the city are calling the program an example for other cities to give new life to their vacant properties. And finally, a controversial lawsuit has been settled between the state of California and one of its counties. The state alleged that San Bernardino County did not include considerations for reducing greenhouse gas emissions as part of its latest general plan, a new state requirement. But the suit has stopped short of court on an agreement that allows the county 30 months to amend its plan to include policies that will reduce greenhouse gas emissions in what is one of the most rapidly developing counties in the state. The new agreement has many in the county worrying that making the required amendments to the general plan could hinder that development. But the state says that compared to the potential detriment to the environment, the county's loss would be a small price to pay. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of Planetizen. After a short break, we'll talk with Martine Gomez about the changes in public libraries. Smart City is made possible in part by the support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Regional Chamber, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Martine Gomez is president of the Urban Libraries Council, a national organization dedicated to strengthening the public library as an essential part of public life. Prior to joining ULC, Martine was executive director of the Friends and Foundation of the San Francisco Public Library, executive director of the Brooklyn Public Library, and director of the Oakland Public Library. Martine, in a world gone digital and with so much content free and readily available, why do we still need to be investing in libraries filled with books?
Well, in part because people are still coming. In a more in a very recent report that was done by the American Library Association, about 1.8 billion people visited their library in 2006. Now, that's not just public libraries. That's school libraries and university libraries. And they circulated over 2 billion items. So there is a demand. If you look at all the metrics that we use in the library world, people are still finding the library in their community as a good local resource.
Is the demand for books growing?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, there are more books being published now than there ever were before. I read a statistic recently that showed that people think that everything's going to be digitized. Well, it may eventually become digital, but at the moment, only about 7% of the books that are published are actually published in an electronic format. So there's still a long way to go, and I think that whether it's you're going to the beach or you have a few moments in the doctor's office, it's nice to cuddle up with a nice paperback, and we're still going to be providing books for at least a couple generations to come, as far as I can see.
I guess we're a both-and society rather than an either-or.
Well, you're very right. You know, in part, what's happened is that we've just added another medium. There was a time when back in the day, I guess, when there were the roller piano, the player pianos came out, and people thought, oh, no, this is going to be the end of piano playing and parlor activities. But in effect, what's happened, we just multiplied the different formats as well as the different types of opportunities people have to access information for educational purposes or for entertainment purposes. So we've added another medium here.
If you want to be a really smart citizen and take full advantage of your library, how should you use it?
Well, the first thing is, I think you need to make sure you have a library card. But many of our libraries around the country, public libraries, are locally independent, owned and operated by municipal government or special library districts. To take advantage of them to their fullest, you need to get a library card. And for the most part, in most communities, if not all, those library cards are free. Two-thirds of Americans have reported that they actually own a library card in this country and visit approximately 11 times a year. So having said that, to take advantage of, I think it's good to do a couple things. One is you need to be able to get to know your staff at your library. They get to know your reading interests. They also can help you find information that you perhaps may not have known existed. So know your staff, frequent your library. And I think this is a very important part, too. Let the people who are in charge of funding libraries know that you value the services that they provide.
You mentioned that libraries are locally owned and, of course, locally funded. Schools get federal funding. Certainly they get state funding. Why don't libraries? Why do we fund schools and libraries separately? Aren't they both in the business of learning?
Well, they're both about education, I guess. And yes, learning, I guess. That's probably the larger concept here. I think part of it has to do with the idea that education, public education in this country anyway, is a constitutional right, access to public information. And it's a policy that's been adopted by the federal government for a couple of centuries now. Public libraries, however, are not federally mandated services at the at a federal level. Therefore, the way we approach the funding and the way we look at performance of libraries versus performance of schools and educational programs are very different. You know, about 85% of funding for libraries is local. There is a small portion of funding that comes from the federal and state governments, depending on which state you live in. And then the other trend that's really interesting is that recently many libraries have developed a philanthropic arm for their library, trying to raise and tap into any local philanthropy, philanthropy as well as national philanthropy. So I think it's historical, you know, the reason why libraries are funded differently. There's also this whole idea that when you look at whether it's Ben Franklin or Andrew Carnegie, the people who've supported the significant library development movement in this country, many of those libraries have been started with the help of volunteers and volunteer collections. One of the greatest libraries in the public libraries in the world, the New York Public Library, it was a combination of three wealthy families who decided that the collections for those libraries and library services should be donated by the wealthy.
Clearly, people are using libraries. You make that point. We're using them a lot. So why don't we adequately fund them out of our own pocketbooks, our tax dollars?
Well, I think part of it is that we've become accustomed to them and learned to take them for granted. The other thing is that I think that people don't understand kind of the governance structure for libraries. Not to put people to sleep necessarily, but as I mentioned a few minutes ago, many of the public libraries are locally funded, but you and I may not know that funding comes from a variety of sources. In some communities, it comes from property taxes. In some cases, it comes from a special assessment. And for the most part, the amount of money that is used to fund those libraries is very, very small.
You produced a recent report called The Engaged Library. Describe an engaged library and what it contributes to its communities.
Well, I think the whole idea is that we need to look at libraries as a part of a larger collection of community assets. And that is those institutions and those community organizations that really contribute to the economic, cultural, and the quality of life, if you will. When you look at the library as a community asset, you begin to see that it has the ability, not standing alone, but in collaboration with its other institutions, whether they're museums or public education or universities, they have the capacity to do even so much more to help communities solve and find solutions to local issues and concerns. The second dimension of that is looking at librarians as community players in part of that entire scope of services that libraries offer. So our report really looked at a case study, if you will, of the Chicago Public Library, and looked at how a librarian in one of their branch libraries was engaged in local issues and how they were basically at the table in their neighborhood to help position the library as an institution that would help to find and provide services that were important to those communities.
Do librarians want that responsibility? Why should it be their responsibility to solve community problems?
Well, librarianship has been around over 100 years, and actually in the States I'm talking about, but certainly before that with the Great Library of Alexandria, and throughout history there have been great libraries. But our role has really evolved. I think for some of the folks who were involved in the library profession, let's say in the 60s and 70s, that might have been kind of the more traditional role, to be the caretaker, the gatekeeper, the aggregator of information, those who would help to develop a collection that was if the best of, if you will. Now I think that role is changing because of the, as we mentioned earlier, the increased information that's available on the internet. So many of the libraries, in addition to having responsibility for managing collections, also have a responsibility, I think, to be able to be connected to the community and make sure that the library is responsive to those needs of the community. So it's not just about making sure that the interior, the internal parts of the library are working well, but also making sure that the library's stature in the community is also seen as valuable. And that's important. That's important for not only finding solutions, but also is the more visible the library is, I think the better supported those libraries can be.
Are librarians ready to step up to that role of broader community leadership and sit at the table with community leaders and influence larger community decisions even when they don't directly involve the library?
Well, at the Urban Libraries Council, I'd like to think that the directors of the large urban libraries in this country are up to the task. As a matter of fact, we've made a point of trying to ensure that that occurs. We established, with the help of a grant from the Institute for Museum and Library Services, something called the Executive Leadership Institute. And what we try to do in that program is to make sure, we're first trying to make sure that we have a leadership for the future, but also to help those individuals understand that part of their responsibility, if not the majority of their responsibility, is to be able to be connected to the community. Now, not everybody is going to be the head of a library, of course, and there are going to be people who do a lot of support work in those libraries, whether it's assisting folks with computer access, helping parents with young children understand and appreciate good literature for children, and helping students with their homework. So there are a lot of different roles that are emerging, but certainly leadership at the community level is something that is emerging and evolving, and I think we are up to the task.
You mentioned the fact that libraries become places that help families understand what to read with their children, help students with after-school homework. How do you manage the range of people who come into a library? It's not as if you can say, no, I want you and don't want you. You get homeless people looking for a place to stay. You get kids who show up after school unsupervised for free daycare. How do you manage it?
I think anybody who's gone into librarianship, specifically public librarianship, knows that that comes with the territory. We are open access to all. At the same time, we have to balance that with local policies and expectations of what we can and can't do. Again, every library is local, and this is going to vary community to community. But overall, I think people, the library staff understands that if I'm going to work in a public institution, whether it's a public library or a public museum, let's say, that that kind of comes with the territory. You need good leadership. You need good connections. I think if you're going to be dealing with the homeless community, a good library staff and good library leader there would know that it's their responsibility to make sure that they're connected with homeless service agencies, certainly people who need to have some immediate help, and whether it's medical or social, that they know where to refer people to for those kinds of services. I won't tell you that it's all good. I mean, there are occasions where there are difficulties, and sometimes they end up in court. But overall, I think we understand that that's part of our responsibility.
Can you name a community where the head of the public library system is considered to be a full-fledged leader and is sitting as an equal to, say, the university president or a corporate CEO?
Well, there are a lot of different types of public libraries, and it would be difficult for me to point to any one person, but I'll tell you, there are some of the larger urban centers in the country, and these are libraries that have demonstrated over time a strong community role as well as a strong influence on development of a community. Los Angeles Public Library sticks out as one, where they've done a complete renovation of virtually every library throughout the community. And Los Angeles has a large footprint with, as you know, a very diverse population. Fontaine Holmes is the director at that library. She, over the last 20 years, took leadership in developing a brand new library development program, starting with the new main library and basically renovating and building several new branches throughout Los Angeles. As a matter of fact, last year we recognized her with what we call the ULC, Urban Libraries Council Urban Player Award. The Toronto Public Library is another interesting model because the leadership there, I think, from Joe Bryant has been extraordinary in that they have now the largest municipal public library in the entire world in terms of size and scope, I believe over 120 branches. And what Joe's done there is the city, as you may know, has amalgamated. In other words, they've taken on other neighboring jurisdictions and folded them into the city of Toronto, which meant that the libraries that existed in some of those smaller jurisdictions became part of the Toronto Public Library. It took several years for the amalgamation to take place, as well as the all the different labor agreements and union issues, as well as the pay scales, etc. So a different kind of leadership, but certainly somebody, Joe, I think, demonstrated some significant leadership there. I was going to also mention Chicago Public Library, I think, is another example of some very good leadership at the top of the library. Mary Dempsey is the library commissioner here. With Mary and with Joe and Fontaine Holmes, and by the way, if you didn't notice, these are all women who have taken leadership in their local cities. What it really boils down to, in my opinion, having also been a library director in my career, is that you need to be able to foster the kinds of relationships with the influential leadership in the community. Mary Dempsey in Chicago with Mayor Daley and the city council, certainly Joe Bryant and their mayor in Toronto, Los Angeles Public Library, and Fontaine Holmes. Over the years, and these are things that you work on diligently day after day as a library director, to cultivate those kinds of relationships, to be able to be successful in maneuvering throughout all the politics. And you know, the politics in neighborhoods and city council districts can be very, very difficult. But in order to be successful, these individuals that I just mentioned, I think, have proven that they have what it takes to be effective leaders.
Is it as much a political job as anything else?
I think that on any given day, it can be 100% politics. There's also certainly the internal work as well. The politics there may be different, but you know, if you don't exercise leadership politically, it's very hard to have the troops who work for you to have faith in your leadership ability internally. So it's at least 90%, if not 100%.
What is the librarian's biggest challenge?
That's a tough question. You know, I don't think I can give it one. I think it is a leadership issue. It has to do with the politics. That's high on my list. I think immediately following that is we are an evolving institution. The technology has put different kinds of pressures on us. And I think what we're trying to understand here and define is what is our role in the 21st century, the digital age in particular. We've done a really good job, I think, of demonstrating that the technology is not only a useful backroom tool for circulating library materials, but also an increasingly an important front room tool. By that I mean many libraries are taking leadership roles in digitizing local archives, historical photographs of their communities, doing some local work that's very, very important. Now, individually that's important, but if you look at it as a whole across the country, there aren't many federal agencies or state agencies that are going to necessarily be as interested as the local library might be in, let's say, Chicago history or New York history or Brooklyn history, as an example. I guess the third area that's really a challenge, I think, is what I mentioned before in helping to shape the essential skills for your library staff. Just as a side note, we also have a variety, almost as many libraries that there are in the country. There are also several different types of governance structures. So fold into that mix of the technology, the staff development, as well as your leadership at the municipal level, the whole idea that you've got also have a library board in many cases that is providing oversight to the decisions that you make as a library director. So a library director's work is pretty much 24/7.
You've begun thinking about the future of the library. What are the outlines of that future, and what are the drivers?
Well, we started something at the Urban Libraries Urban Libraries Council called Foresight 2020, and it's an aggressive initiative that we're hoping to help us develop some answers about our many futures in society, not only here in the States, but globally. We've brought somebody in to help us understand the forces that are impacting the library industry. And we are an industry. We're not just a local, we are local certainly, but when you think of the buying power for many of our libraries, we're looking at, upwards of $6 billion that libraries spend nationally on library materials. So we have influence and can influence the publishing industry. We also want to be able to showcase, I think, in this future foresight initiative, some of the things that our colleagues are doing across the country that are very new service models. So we also want to promote the idea that part of our job is to not only think about the future, but also share information about what's working in different areas.
In your mind, what's the best thing that could come out of Foresight 2020?
I think what we're hoping for is that there would be a small handful of alternative scenarios of what the role of the public library will be in the future. And within that framework, give our members some space to exchange information and to experiment with some of those different models that will evolve over time. And also give our members an opportunity to share information about what's working and what doesn't work in their situations. Now, as publicly funded institutions, it's very difficult to find what I call venture capital to take some risks on new ventures. Government likes to see success. They don't necessarily like to see failure. So given all of that, I think the challenge will be developing some scenarios that are not only plausible, but have enough risk in them that we'll have some new leadership emerge.
If you could start from scratch, Martine, no buildings, no systems, no books, no legacy systems, how would you design a library? Or would you design a library?
You know, I would design a library for the 21st century, and in part because what's evolved for us is not only a place for people to come and check materials out, but also in many cases we've become a community center in many neighborhoods as well as in downtown areas. So I think increasingly our role as not only a provider and of access to knowledge and information, whether it's in hard copy or via the internet, we also, I think, provide an important role as a place for community to congregate, to share ideas. Most libraries these days, for example, are being built with large auditoriums capable of seating 300 to 600 people so that ideas can be brought to the table, to the community, for sharing of information of whether new trends in business or new trends in authors, for example, that come in to share information about their latest publication. So space would be a very important point for us. The other piece, I think, and there's some very interesting models right now, the Seattle Public Library comes to mind, where there is some bold architecture that really kind of pushes the envelope, not only design for municipal facilities, but also really expands the imagination for people who enter that building. One of the things that's been an interesting byproduct of that library is that it's actually become a tourist destination. That building was designed by Rem Koolhaas out of the Netherlands, and it's quite a spectacular building. So space is important. Design is critically important, I think, for stirring the imagination. And I do think that our role as a place for community to congregate, I mean, you don't necessarily want to hang out, in all my due respect to the post office, you don't necessarily want to hang out at the post office or, and increasingly public schools. It's getting to be more and more difficult for people to use those spaces as public spaces.
Does library show up in any economic development strategy you're familiar with?
Well, interestingly, yes. We have just completed a report at the Urban Libraries Council with the help of the Washington, D.C.-based Urban Institute. It's called Making Cities Stronger. And we specifically wanted to find out how is it that libraries can and are making a difference in what we call economic development? I think what we found out is that it's not only economic, it's also community development. But there are five areas in particular that we believe that libraries can make a difference. One is our early literacy service programs that we provide to children and young adults. Increasingly, libraries are becoming more and more actively engaged in providing literacy service for kids. And that certainly contributes to the long-term economic success of a community because a literate community is an important asset for job development as well as an educated workforce. The other is the whole idea that libraries actually provide information on employment and career resources, helping prepare workers for changes in with new technology in the workforce. So many libraries are not only providing public access and computers, but they're also providing classes in how do you use some of the software programs, from writing resumes to actually doing job searches. Small business is another area where we've been very active and supportive, I think, in developing, actually lowering the bar to market entry. Many of the small businesses, and as you know, Carol, that there are many communities where small businesses are the predominant job provider, especially in poor urban communities. So small businesses, the entrepreneurship that takes place there relies on important data. Many public libraries have access and provide free access to a lot of important databases that would be helpful to people who are developing small businesses. The other area, of course, we talked about briefly having to do with public library buildings as catalysts for physical development. Increasingly, we're finding out that libraries and developers are looking at libraries as anchor institutions. In a mall, for example, or a neighborhood development, it's an important asset for attracting other businesses, as well as sustaining traffic into the shopping mall or other locations. So those are some of the examples that we have for our contributions to community development.
And what are you reading this summer?
Well, I haven't had too much time to read, but what I'm reading right now is a children's book, actually, that came out a while back. It's called Summerland. It's by Michael Chabon. I recommend it.
Martin Gomez is president of the Urban Libraries Council. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. This week's City View's commentator Walker Smith explains how easy it is to settle for the status quo.
The hassles of air travel are worse than ever. But I'm on a plane so much that I barely even notice anymore. I've become like many other frequent flyers. I just don't worry too much about the aggravations because that's the way it is. In fact, I don't know many frequent flyers who even talk much about air travel. We wear our indifference as a badge of honor. But in fact, this nonchalance shows just how out of touch we are. We are so inured to the nuisances of air travel that we lose sight of just how bad it has become. Air travel really is unpleasant. I know this because I hear other people complain about it in airports. Not frequent flyers like me, but occasional flyers who are surprised to discover just how much they have to take off to go through security or just how much it costs to get a bite to eat. The lines for checking luggage are longer, as are the waits for collecting luggage. Planes are more tattered than ever, with basic amenities hard to come by. Delays, cancellations, and confusion are the norm. It is barely contained chaos that seems perfectly normal to me until I am reminded by the reactions of others that this is madness. I suppose I have gotten to the point where I am just willing to live with the compromises, no matter what they are. In those rare moments of clarity when I can see air travel for what it truly is, I worry that I have become too cut off from the reality of the situation to fully appreciate how bad things have become. This is true for many things. We get so used to things that aren't as good as they should or could be that we lose our determination or sense of outrage to make things better. Without realizing it, we give up and settle for less. The compromises start to seem acceptable, even good. Eventually, we forget how things ought to be because we have become too comfortable with the way things are. The best way I've found to keep my perspective is to take the input of other people seriously. They're not caught up in it like me, so they can offer a view of the situation that is less compromised by being so close to it. Otherwise, I would never see how much I am willing to settle for the worst. Unfortunately, though, our natural tendency is to defend our view on the basis that we know so much about it. Yet there are many situations where too much knowledge and too much connection can get in the way of the best decision. We all feel this way sometimes, even collectively as a nation. So when I find myself thinking that we don't need to worry about what other countries think as our nation is contemplating strategic, military, and economic decisions, I remind myself of my perspective on airports. Listening to others is the only way I know to keep myself from falling into the trap of taking compromise for granted and of giving up on the way things ought to be. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich and author of the forthcoming book, Generation Ageless, in bookstores October 2nd. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders who just released the new report, Kids in Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.